Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome to the second episode of the Five Cases podcast. The Five Cases podcast summarises five cases on a range of topics relevant to criminal lawyers in New South Wales. I'm Caitlin Akhtar of Forbes Chambers, and I'm speaking to you from Gadigal land.
And I'm Sophie Anderson of Commercial Bank Chambers in Lismore, and I am speaking to you from beautiful Bundjalung country. These case reviews are meant as a brief update to assist practitioners stay abreast of the current case law. We won't be discussing any cases at great length. We're just trying to highlight a number of cases that might assist you to make your own inquiries of cases to assist your advocacy. They are not meant to be a complete case summary, and we encourage you to actually refer to the full judgments. There are links in the show notes to this episode.
In today's edition, which is recorded on the 6th of July 2023, we're looking at cases dealing with the following topics.
I'll talk about two different cases on parity, both handed down in quick succession and both having a common feature, that being that the lead judgment of both of those decisions is by Her Honour Justice Sweeney. I'll also discuss a case about whether the court can restrict the access of an accused person to parts of their brief.
I'll be looking at a case on the lawfulness of arrest and one about apprehended bias of a magistrate, recusal and traversal of plea. But why don't you start us off, Sophie?
I'd love to, Caitlin. Thanks. So the first decision I was going to refer you to is R. and Dyson, 2023, New South Wales CCA 132, handed down on the 2nd of June 2023. Briefly, what happened was that Mr. Dyson was sentenced in the district court at first instance for directing activities of a criminal group, also of supplying commercial quantity of cocaine. And at the time of these offences, he was subject to an ICO. He was said to be part of a chapter of an OMCG in a regional area. His co-accused was dealt with in the local court for a single count of participating in a criminal group. On Dyson's district court sentence, the facts that related to his co-offender were substantially different. The co-accused had also been sentenced to a 13-month ICO with 5 months custody, bail refused taken into account. The judge who sentenced Mr. Dyson tried to undertake a comparison of the facts of each offender as he was provided with both on sentence, and essentially what he said in relation to each accused facts is that the other offender was said to have been more criminally involved. His Honour provided a detailed summation of the authorities on parity. He then sentenced Mr. Dyson to an aggregate sentence of 2 years, 3 months with a non-parole period of 1 year and 9 months. The Crown appealed on three grounds, which were directed largely to the application of the parity principles and the overall sentence being one that was, they said, manifestly inadequate. The CCA found, with Justice Sweeney having the lead judgment and with whom their Honours Button and Hamill agreed, that the sentencing process had miscarried and that the sentence was manifestly inadequate. But ultimately finding that the court would not exercise its discretion to interfere in the sentence. The principles of parity are set out by Her Honour at paragraph 54 and include six statements of principle based on decisions in the CCA in relation to principles of parity. It not uncommonly occurs that co-offenders are sentenced by different judges or by different courts and on the basis of different facts or evidence.
Okay, so what does this case tell us about parity? And particularly what I'm wondering about is parity where you've got one accused in the local court and one in the DC.
Well, I mean, that happens all the time, doesn't it? But it's quite an interesting little conundrum. So Her Honour went through the basic recitations of the long-held principles of equality in sentencing. And during the initial sentence in the district court, the court was also taken to the decision of Greaves 2020, New South Wales CCA 140, which is on point in terms of where one co-offender is dealt with in the local court and the other in the district court. And really what that said was that the parity principle was applicable even in those circumstances where the charges are not even the same, but it still applies in respect of the co-offenders. The next case I wanted to talk about is again another illustration of the parity principles and what work they have to do in sentencing.
Great. Well, hit us with it.
Great. So that's the decision of Ritchie and R, 2023, New South Wales CCA 153, handed down in the same month of June, but on the 23rd of June. That decision followed Dyson, and in that court, the court was constituted by Justices Adamson, McNaughton and Sweeney again. This was a successful manifest excess appeal by Mr. Ritchie in relation to his sentence, but it dealt with the issues of parity along with other principles, including bug me factors and mental illness. But for the purpose of today, I just want to focus on that parity point. So the facts in that case were pretty unique in the sense that Mr. Ritchie had, with his co-accused Mr. Russell and also an accessory, been sentenced by the same judge in the district court. In terms of this factual scenario, the issue of parity was between Mr. Russell and Mr. Ritchie's sentence. Both had pleaded guilty to wound with intent to cause grievous bodily harm. The facts were that Ritchie, who was 19 at the time, Russell and another man who was sentenced as an accessory had violently assaulted a man called Holland after he had himself violently assaulted his ex-partner. Russell, Ritchie and the other man had arrived at the scene and upon doing so basically commenced an attack on Holland in the front yard. Ritchie armed himself with a knife that Russell had brought to the scene and he stabbed Holland four times in the stomach and chest. Ritchie's facts, which was slightly different from Russell's, said that the three men punched and kicked Holland, who fell to the ground twice and then got back up twice, and each time he got back up, the three men continued to kick and punch him. Then they all left in the car. He was initially sentenced to 8 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 5 years and 8 months. The same judge who sentenced the co-accused Russell, who was then 21 years old, but after Ritchie, was sentenced to a two-year ICO. So on appeal, Justice Sweeney went through the principles in relation to parity again from paragraph 68 onwards and found that His Honour's assessment, that is the initial judge's assessment, of the objective seriousness of the offences, the discounts that were given to each of the offenders because of their plea of guilty, and their personal circumstances did not actually justify the disparity between the sentences. And you can see there that there's actually a really big disparity in those sentences. Ultimately, the court re-sentenced Mr. Ritchie to a period of 5 years imprisonment with a non-parole period of 3 years.
Right. Again, so that's an interesting kind of exercise between two co-offenders who have the same judge, but their sentences are very different, at least to start with.
Yes. They're a really interesting set of cases, aren't they? And they both illustrate the principles of parity and how they apply in sentencing. Hopefully they will help everyone if those issues arise in their own cases.
Great. Okay. Well, I might now turn to the law of arrest and a recent case in that area. The case I want to talk about is AD and the State of New South Wales, 2023 New South Wales CA, so Court of Appeal, 115. So AD and the State of New South Wales considers, as I said, the law governing arrest. What happened is that AD intervened in a fight that occurred between her ex-husband and her current partner during a handover between AD and her ex-husband of the children. So police arrested AD in her home 2 weeks later. AD was charged with recklessly inflicting grievous bodily harm, and she was served with an apprehended domestic violence order that prohibited her from contacting the ex-husband or her children. Police then immediately removed the children from AD's home and placed them in the ex-husband's care. AD filed a claim against the State of New South Wales for trespass, false imprisonment, and misfeasance in public office, and that claim was dismissed. AD was only given leave to appeal against the dismissal of her claim for the false imprisonment on the basis her arrest was unlawful. Acting Judge of Appeal Baston found at paragraph 16 that at the time of arresting AD, the officer's true intention was to have AD put on bail conditions and the conditions of the AVO. His Honour considered this purpose to fall within section 99(1)(b)(8) of LEPRA, which we would know to be the power of arrest, section 99 of LEPRA. And section 99(1)(b)(8) is protecting the safety or welfare of any person. At paragraph 20, His Honour disagreed with the idea that the arrest itself must be intended to provide the protection. He held that the arrest for the purpose of putting a person on bail conditions to achieve a purpose in section 99 was lawful. His Honour referred to the second reading speech in 2013 when this section was amended that identified the intention of the amendment of the section to be to uncuff police so they can handcuff criminals. His Honour made clear that the person who must be satisfied that an arrest is reasonably necessary for the purpose of section 99 of LEPRA is the arresting officer. At paragraph 19, His Honour said that while the police officer's view is not unreviewable, the arrest will be lawful unless it's shown either that the officer did not genuinely consider the arrest reasonably necessary or the officer's view was manifestly unreasonable, arbitrary or capricious.
So interesting, Caitlin, and particularly in terms of the evolution of the decisions on section 99, fascinating that that particular amendment to uncuff police was referred to. But this is obviously a civil case, so how does it help criminal lawyers?
Well, that's a good question. The court's assessment of the lawfulness of arrest, I think, is instructive in terms of applications for exclusion of evidence that we would often come across pursuant to section 138 of the Evidence Act. So section 99 of LEPRA doesn't change according to whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. It might also be instructive for the hearing of offences with an element that the officer was acting in the execution of their duty at a relevant time. So the other case I want to talk about is McQuillan and R, number 2, 2023, New South Wales SC, that's Supreme Court, 443. So in this case, the Supreme Court considered the apprehended bias of a magistrate in a plea traversal application in a local court. The appellant sought to withdraw her plea of guilty to an offence, that's pursuant to section 207 of the Criminal Procedure Act. And on an earlier date in the proceedings, the magistrate had recused themselves from the hearing of the application because of their personal knowledge of the solicitor who had represented the appellant when she'd entered her plea. However, the magistrate later resolved to preside over the hearing. When the application for withdrawal of plea was heard, the magistrate determined that that earlier solicitor, with whom the magistrate was familiar, was unavailable for the purpose of section 65 of the Evidence Act, although there was no application made to the magistrate seeking this finding. The prosecutor relied on the statutory declaration of that solicitor in resisting the application for traversal of plea. The appellant gave evidence that she'd always intended to pursue a section 32 and that she only reluctantly accepted the solicitor's advice to plead guilty after he told her he was not ready for hearing and the magistrate was going to convict her no matter what. The appellant said she thought a report for a section 32 application was going to be prepared during an adjournment after entering her plea, but this never happened. It was common ground that the appellant had never seen the agreed facts that were tendered on the entry of her plea. But the magistrate concluded the plea had involved a free and voluntary confession, and in doing so, the magistrate took into account the appellant's criminal record as evidence of her familiarity with the court system. The magistrate also took into account that the appellant's evidence about pursuing a section 32 was not supported by any reference to this in the statutory declaration of the earlier solicitor who had entered the plea. The Supreme Court determined that the magistrate ought to have recused themselves and ordered that the application for withdrawal of plea be remitted to the local court to be heard by a different magistrate.
So, again, very interesting, but not technically a criminal case. What do you think practitioners should take from it?
Well, this is the Supreme Court acting in its supervisory jurisdiction. So it's specifically for the Supreme Court to make determinations about whether decisions of the local court have been made according to law. And I think that it's important because recusal is a really difficult subject for practitioners to broach. And it's something that I think a lot of practitioners would have faced is the question of whether to raise the idea that a magistrate should recuse themselves. There was also reference in that case to the case being heard in a regional area, and I think that's something that you and I and a lot of other practitioners would be familiar with, so I think that hopefully it's of some guidance to practitioners. Now, I think, speaking of a local court, you've got another case reviewing a local court decision to finish us up for today.
Yeah, that's right. So this is another interesting decision from the Supreme Court. It goes by the name of Commissioner of Police and Walker, 2023 New South Wales Supreme Court 539, and it was also handed down on the 23rd of June 2023. Briefly, Walker was charged with offences including murder and was remanded in custody as a result. And as one would normally expect, his legal representatives were provided with a brief. During the local court proceedings, the Crown sought an order to restrict or restrain the accused from actually retaining parts of his brief with him whilst he was in custody. And they sought this under what they called, or what is called, a restricted retention order, or a RRO, citing that they had concerns for the safety of prosecution witnesses who presumably had given statements to the Crown. So in the local court, the magistrate refused the order, finding that it was beyond jurisdiction. But when the Crown appealed to the Supreme Court to review the decision, Her Honour Justice McNaughton quashed that order of the magistrate, finding that there was in fact some power to restrict access, and then sent the matter back to the local court. So in terms of the decision, the relevant provisions that it considers is Section 61, subsection 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which provides a brief of evidence must be served on an accused. Section 3 of the same Act, defining an accused as somebody who is a defendant and their legal representative. And then also Section 61, subsection 2, which relevantly provides that the division in which it sits in the Criminal Procedure Act, which is Division 3, called Disclosure of Evidence, is subject to any other law or obligation relating to the provision of material to an accused by a prosecutor. So Her Honour found that, amongst other things, there was no unqualified or absolute right under the Criminal Procedure Act for an accused to have the whole of the brief with them at all times. That was at paragraph 65. For example, it is possible that a duty of confidentiality owed by police to a witness could justify limiting an accused access to their brief. Whether a RRO is made and how that is to be framed is to be determined by balancing competing public policy considerations, including the individual rights of the accused, and could be crafted to solve particular issues which may arise in particular cases. And that was following the High Court decision in HT and the Queen from 2019-269-CLR-403. But of note was Her Honour delving into the roles and responsibilities of solicitors in relation to briefs. This is important because, as we all know in practice, sometimes it's a natural assumption that the brief forwarded to the offender, even when they're in custody, unless there's some obvious reason. For example, it's a CSA matter, or the accused has specifically requested that it not be. But Her Honour noted that the Criminal Procedure Act is silent as to how solicitors are to obtain instructions in relation to the brief. Her Honour suggested that on occasion, solicitors may not make an additional copy of the brief available for their client, but instead invite them, of course if they're not in custody, to attend a location to view the brief, and that this would not be in breach of those provisions in the Criminal Procedure Act. If an accused is in custody and has been provided with a copy of the brief, there will at times be when they can't have it. Her Honour's view was that this would not breach the provisions within the Criminal Procedure Act, but merely reflects the exigencies of custody. That was from paragraphs 63 to 64 and referred in part to section 72, subsection 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act. So the court also then went on to consider self-represented litigants or accused and said that in the case of people who are self-repped, most but not all of the same public policy considerations will apply, and so far as they are different, don't stop the making of a RRO. Her Honour urged that a practical approach should be taken.
So this case deals with an accused in custody who wishes to access the evidence against them, which is a really important issue. And in the last few years, there's been a lot of work done to allow inmates to access electronic briefs via a laptop, and that's called the e-brief system. This is an issue that I've had quite a lot of experience with, and it's the first time that I'm aware of it's been considered by a court. So I'd be very interested to hear of developments in this area.
Yeah, and maybe that's a good time to remind listeners that we're really keen to hear from you about cases or issues you'd like us to look at in future episodes. And thanks very much for your time and listening.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, if you haven't already caught it, we definitely recommend listening to Yarning with an Inmate, A Perspective from Inside, which is a really fascinating conversation recorded by legal aid solicitor Cody Baxter. And it's available from the same page as this episode. Catch you next time.
See you later.